And we're back. It's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Deborah Dean's new novel, The Mirrored World, tells the story of an 18th century saint. Her rejection of materialism brought her into conflict with the court of the Empress Catherine the Great. Saint Xenia was born into nobility, but after her husband died, she gave away all of her possessions. She dedicated her life to helping the poor. In her new novel, Deborah Dean poses the question, was Xenia driven by religious fervor or grief-induced madness? Dean, a creative writing professor at Florida International University, invites us to come up with our own answer. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Dean. He began by asking her if sainthood and insanity go hand in hand.
I think you could make an argument for that. The idea, if you think about what leads one to being a saint, it really is acting against your own self-interest. And it's stepping outside the norms of society. It's interesting, too, because in Russia, there's not the same ideas that we have about insanity. In fact, it really wasn't even a term that anyone would have understood in Russia at the time in the 18th century. You're looking at what norms are, and where insanity is just something past, you know, the on the outside ranges. And people define it differently. You might think it's not a cultural thing, but it really is. And so in Russia, they're much more tolerant of people outside of the norms, even now, and certainly in the time, in the 18th century when my novel is set.
Well, your novel tells the story of a saint. I'm trying to pronounce your name correctly.
Xenia.
Xenia. Okay, Xenia. And she's a little-known figure. I'd never heard of her before.
You wouldn't have heard of her unless you were Russian Orthodox.
Exactly. And you do a very good job of recreating 18th-century Russian society.
Thank you.
That was a period of transition, wasn't it?
It was very much a period of transition. I used to think the 18th century was like the boring century.
Oh, no, not at all.
Not at all. No. It's and in Russia, it's really interesting because the country is sort of being dragged onto the European stage. And first Peter the Great and then his daughter Elizaveta and then famously Catherine the Great were pushing the Russian people to become more European. And so for this period of the novel, the first half of the 18th century on forward, it's almost like the culture is really schizophrenic. They speak Russian at home, but they speak French when they're out in the court, and they dress like Russians, and they have, at home, they dress like Europeans when they're out in the world. And the culture maintains the old ways and the old superstitions and beliefs, but there's also reasoning coming in. Voltaire was greatly admired by Catherine the Great. So I think Russians really were sort of tipped one way or the other. They weren't quite sure what to do. And so it's a very self-conscious, highly self-conscious society.
But beneath it all, there was still that barbarity, that savagery.
Yeah. What Dostoevsky talks about, the Russian people being half saint, half savage.
Yes. And you show that in the novel. One thing that stood out for me was the Ice Palace. And this was actually something that did take place. You didn't make it up.
No, I did not.
No. But that was something created out of cruelty. It was a beautiful thing made out of cruelty. What was the Ice Palace?
Well, Empress Anna Ivanovna, who was the first Romanov Empress, she was widowed when she was very young. And one of the results of that is that for the rest of her life, one of her favorite pastimes was arranging marriages for those beneath her. And she had this one advisor who really ticked her off. And in order to get back at him, she stripped him of his title. He was a prince. And she made him her court jester. And then to rub a little more salt in the wound, she arranged a marriage for him to one of her maids, who was a hunchbacked old woman. And she threw a big citywide party and had a parade, and the bride and groom were in an iron cage strapped on the back of an elephant and paraded through the city. And then she had built this little miniature palace on the frozen river, on the Neva in the center of the city. And it resembled a palace, but it was just smaller. And everything in it was made of ice. The whole palace was made of ice, and it was all furnished with ice beds and tableware, everything. And they had a wedding, and this was where the bride and groom were forced to spend the night in the middle of one of the coldest winters on record. So yes, very cruel. Mm. They did actually survive the night, but just barely.
We're speaking with FIU creative writing professor Deborah Dean, whose new novel is entitled The Mirrored World. Why do you call this The Mirrored World?
Well, it was a title that was arrived at after many other iterations. When I'm writing, I usually expect the title to sort of show up about halfway through the writing, and you have a working title, and my working title for this was Exania, and nothing else came to me. And I kept writing and I kept writing. I had a whole list of possible titles and I would work on it sometimes and nothing really stuck. And I got all the way to the end of the novel and I turned it into my editor and I said, what do you think? Can I just call it Exania? And she said, sure. And I said, really? Are you sure? Because I'm going to go out and talk about it and it'll get out on the internet and that'll be it. And she said, no problem. Well, then the marketing department came back to me and they said, absolutely, please do not do this, Deborah. Please don't call it Exania because nobody knows how to pronounce it. And obviously from a marketing perspective, that's not good.
You'll probably misinterpret as Xena, warrior princess.
Yeah, exactly. So I worked with the publishers and I proposed a title and they rejected it. They proposed a title and I rejected it. And finally we came up with this. And it's not exactly on the nose, but there's a lot of mirrors as imagery throughout the novel, and it is in part reflective, excuse the pun, of the society, that this very highly self-conscious society. And then also the idea of the mirrors, a lot of the mirrors in the novel are images that are warped or changed in the reflection. And so the society, the court society, which is highly, wildly extravagant, is also in some ways mirrored by the extreme deprivation and poverty of the other 99% of the culture. And one of the main characters, Exania, moves from one extreme of the culture to the other.
Because Exania was born in an upper-class family.
Yes.
We see her as a child. We first see her as a child. The novel is narrated not by Xenia, but by her cousin.
Right.
Dasha. And we follow her through a rather lengthy life. I think Xenia lives into her 70s or 80s.
Yeah, historically nobody knows quite, but quite long.
Yes. And Dasha and she, again, grew up in this privileged upbringing. And then something happens. And Exenia has what we would call a breakdown, mm-hmm. but the Russians consider a kind of epiphany, I guess. What happens to Exenia?
Yeah, she's what in Russia is called a holy fool. And that the closest equivalent here would be the Native American shamans. They're people that I think if Exenia were to show up in Miami today, she would probably be put on meds, diagnosed with schizophrenia, and put on meds.
Sure,
but
yeah.
But in old Russia, these people were, they were revered. And the thinking went like this, that all of us are created equal by God. And so people that have very visible defects must also have compensating hidden gifts. And so they would look at people that would be shunned in Europe, and they looked to them for wisdom. And so the holy fools were credited with healing and with prophecy, and the czars all had holy fools in their courts, people to whom they listened and obeyed.
How is Exenia a holy fool? Because I know that what I'm trying to get at is the triggering event is the death of her husband.
Right.
And then after her husband dies, how does she transform?
She, in some of the legends, it's just, you know, it's said that she went mad with grief. And she began to give away all of her worldly possessions and divest herself of everything. And then she disappeared. And there's no record of her for 6 or 7 years. And when she reappears, she was living on the streets in the worst slum in St. Petersburg. And she was dressed in the rags of her husband's military uniform and would only answer to his name. And people started crediting her with miracles. And she became very popular with the people, to the point that she was regarded as a bit of a threat to the establishment and to the court.
Why was she a threat?
Well, historically at this point, Catherine the Great was very much a believer in these ideas of equality to a point. But then when the French Revolution came along, she had second thoughts. And so she became a little bit paranoid. Anybody that she thought might be gathering the people together were regarded as a bit threatening.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with novelist Deborah Dean. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. I'm Ariel Gonzalez, and this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is FIU creative writing professor Deborah Dean, whose new novel, The Mirrored World, tells the story of an 18th century Russian saint. This is a work of historical fiction. In the past, historical fiction has had a rather, shall we say, checkered reputation.
Yes.
This has changed recently, in the last 20 or 30 years. There's been quite a large number of critically acclaimed works of historical fiction. Thomas Mallon is a historical novelist, and he once said that when we're dealing with historical novel, historical fiction, you must always remember that nouns trump adjectives, that it's the noun you should always keep in mind, not the adjective. And so when you're writing your novels, or historical novels, how much of it is dependent on the history and how much of it is dependent on the imagination?
Well, I hew very closely to what really happened, in part because I think a lot of people, wisely or not, read historical fiction as though it is all true. And when I was writing my first novel, The Madonnas of Leningrad, and that was set during the Siege of Leningrad in 1941, it was very important to me to tell the truth of that story. In part because it's not that far in the past. There were people still alive when I was writing this novel that had gone through this experience. So I also knew I could get called out if I got anything wrong. And so I'm very careful to do the research and make sure that I get it right. And then I don't contravene anything that's known. But that usually leaves large gaps. And particularly with this novel, with The Mirrored World, you can find out just about anything you want to know about the 18th century court. But as soon as you step outside of the court, the historical records are not there, because 18th century Russia was largely pre-literate. So the kinds of things that you need to know as a novelist, like what people ate, what they thought, what they did during the day, you get those kinds of things from letters and journals. And if you have a pre-literate society, you don't have those records. So there was lots of room for me to make things up.
Well, you mentioned the Madonnas of Leningrad.
Mm-hmm.
That was your first novel.
Yes.
And it's the story of a woman, and it's actually two sides of this woman. One when she's younger, the other when she's older. We see her in around the 2000s or the 1990s,
yeah.
And she's old and suffering from Alzheimer's. And then, because her disease is eating up her present, she only has her past to rely on. And she looks back at the time when she was a guide at the Hermitage Museum during the Siege of Leningrad. But what amazes me is for that novel and this novel, you don't speak Russian, do you?
No, I don't. No, there's no logical reason for me to have written two novels set in Russia.
In fact, you had never even visited Russia by the time you were working on the first novel.
No. My husband says I was Russian in a former life, and that's the best explanation I can come up with. I am fascinated by Russia, but I came to the Madonnas of Leningrad, and I wrote the Madonnas of Leningrad in part inspired by my own ignorance because I knew so little. And as creative writing teachers, we're often encouraging students with that cliche of write what you know. And there's, you know, it's good advice because it's much easier to write what you know. It's harder to invent or create a world that's not yours and make it true. But I'm much more interested in what I don't know. And with Madonnas of Leningrad, this is my pitch for public television. I watched PBS one night and there was a 3-part special on the Hermitage Museum. And part two was on the siege. And I was fascinated because I had never even heard of the siege of Leningrad. And I thought, how is this possible that over a million people could die civilians? And I would never even heard of it. And so I started researching from there. My curiosity just took me further and further into the story. And then something grabs a hold of you. And I really didn't want to write a novel set in Russia because I knew how difficult it would be. But I do think your stories choose you rather than the other way around. The thing I knew about the second novel was that I didn't know what I was going to write, but I knew it wasn't going to be set in Russia. And there I went again.
Well, we're speaking with FIU creative writing professor Debra Dean, whose new novel is entitled The Mirrored World. Just to stay on Madonnas for a second, years ago I saw this film called Russian Ark, which is
a fictional
movie, which I think is about the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg.
Yeah.
And you, in an interview, mentioned that you saw a website that helped you on the Hermitage, where you saw every room.
Yeah, well, it's the Hermitage website.
It's the Hermitage website.
Yeah, it's a fabulous website.
Uh-huh. And it shows you every room.
You can go, well, there's maps, because the museum is enormous. And there's maps of the museum, and you can click on a room, and it will open up scrolling video of the room. And so you can mouse around the room, and you can slow it down and go in and look more closely at something and speed it up. And then they also have lifetime cameras mounted on the roof of the museum, so you can see the city. And you can spend hundreds and hundreds of hours on that website. And I think well-spent hours. It's a really amazing website.
And it amazes me because the story that you tell in that novel, which is true, about how they evacuated all the artworks from the museum, and yet the staff stayed there. They stayed around, 2,000 people?
Something like that, yeah.
They just lived in the museum.
They lived in the basement.
In the basement.
Yeah, there were bomb shelters underneath the museum, and so what happened is when the Germans first attacked, they started packing up the contents of the museum. And at the time, that was 1.2 million items of art. And they spent several weeks round the clock packing these things up. And they were packed and they were put on trains and shipped out of the city to a secret location so that if Hitler got through the lines, he wouldn't get the art. So they emptied out the museum. But they left the empty frames hanging on the walls as a pledge that the art would come back. And then the staff members, the same people that had packed all of this art up, they moved into the basements because the Nazis were doing what they had done in London, which the Blitz. Every night, 7 o'clock, they would come in and they would start bombing. So these staff members and their families and the scholars, the museums are a little bit different there than they are here. So there were a lot of scientists and archaeologists, people other than just curators and artists. They were all living in the basements, and they lived there for the first winter.
It's amazing. In The Mirrored World, it's narrated, as I said earlier, by Dasha, Xenia's cousin. And in your first novel, The Madonnas of Leningrad, it's a third-person point of view. Is this because both those characters, Marina in the Madonnas of Leningrad and Xenia, they really can't tell their own story?
Yeah.
Because Xenia is, I think, crazy, and Marina is losing it. So you have to distance yourself from these protagonists.
It's a pull. With Madonnas of Leningrad, I wanted to tell the story through the consciousness of somebody with Alzheimer's, because I think if you have a loved one that has Alzheimer's or dementia, there's really a compelling draw to want to know what that experience is like from the inside. And so I tried to tell the story in a way through Marina's point of view, but you can't do it entirely through the point of view of somebody that is losing their memory. So it's third person, but it's a close third person, so it goes in and out of her consciousness. And the same thing was true with Xenia. I really didn't feel like I could inhabit the mind of a holy fool. And so I gave myself a narrator who is in some ways my alter ego and is the person who is somebody who is in love, loves the saint. And the question for me as I was writing the novel is, what would that be like if somebody that you loved started making these choices or doing these things that other people might say, oh, she's a saint, but I'm not so sure if there's such a thing. If, they say there's no man is a prophet in his own country, and I'm not sure any woman is a saint in her own family.
Well, she may be your alter ego, but she marries a castrati.
Yeah, it's not me.
That's not you.
No.
I don't know what your marriage is like. But that character is fascinating. The eunuch, the Francesco
Gaspari.
What's he like? Tell us about that, because he's one of the characters I really was attracted to in this novel.
Yeah, this is based again on historical truth that the empresses imported culture from Europe, and so they had French chefs and German tutors, and they had Italian architects, and they had the castrati, and at the time that they were the rock stars in Europe, and they went all over the place, and in Russia they could afford them. So Gaspari is Italian. He comes in. There's other castrati there as well, and he's like a rock star, but he's also somebody who they swoon over him when he's on stage, but he is also pariah socially.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Deborah Dean.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College.